Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to talk about all aspects of death and dying and demystify it a bit. And I've come across a lovely young man called Joe Cavalli-Price, who I've met through Thames Hospice because they've got a connection together. And he's founded an organisation called Music in Hospices, which sounds such a wonderful idea, that the idea of being able to bring music in to play to people who are dying. So, Joe, lovely to meet you. Thank you for taking part. And tell me how this all began for you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to talk. It was around this time 5 years ago. It was the 19th of November 2019 when I was playing piano in a rehearsal in Cardiff and my phone illuminated and it was a missed call from my dad. And I don't really worry about the odd missed call, but when it got to 6 missed calls, my sort of gut tightened and my heart sank. Because at this point, my mother was 9 years into her diagnosis of a brain tumor. And I had a call from my dad saying that mum had a seizure. It was the worst seizure the ambulance crew had ever seen. I stood up from the piano and I said to the conductor, you know, I have to go, it's mum. And I hopped in my car and when I ran into ICU, I saw my mum there kind of seizing, surrounded by like an incalculable number of tubes keeping her alive. And I always say to people, she died twice for me that day. And the first time was when I saw her in intensive care. And the second time was when the word hospice was mentioned. And it's interesting because I had never heard the word hospice before. And I was like, why did it strike fear into my heart in that moment? And I realized it was because like society hadn't mentioned anything about it. No one had spoken anything about it. You know, I suffered in silence at the word hospice being mentioned. And my mum was admitted. And the first thing that I saw and felt when I was in there was just total tranquility, the beauty of it, the sculpted wild gardens, the light, the community, the patients who were living and reading and eating delicious food and watching TV and having conversations with their family. It was a real place of sort of warmth and brightness. And I was in there with my mum for just about a month. And I realized that there was something missing. And what was missing was an aspect of her that was creative and colorful, lively and vivacious and humorous. I mean, mum sort of had a great love of the arts. We used to go to classical music concerts all the time, to the theater, to art galleries. And she'd always be there with sort of a glass of red wine in one hand, colorful scarf draped around her neck and this sort of devilish sense of humor. But when I looked around the hospice, there was none of that. There was none of that sort of color and vibrancy. And the medical care, I have to say, was extraordinary. And the people, the nurses, all of the members of that community are just extraordinary individuals. But, you know, my mum was unconscious at that moment and she was nonverbal, of course. So I felt like I couldn't really communicate with her. And so one day I was walking around the hospice and I discovered this piano shape under a lot of blankets and covered in books in the corner of the hospice. And I just happened to wheel it to her bedside, really. And I just began to play. I played for her. It was the only way that I felt like I could connect with her in that moment. It was sort of a part of me that mum had encouraged. I was just about to start my master's at the Royal Academy of Music in London at that point. So it was really something that wasn't just a hobby. It was my profession. And I began to play it. And in that moment, I sort of discovered this tranquility that passed over me. Like my breath steadied and my shoulders relaxed. And the music kind of rippled and flowed throughout the hospice. And it was really a personal moment. I didn't expect anything grand to come of it, not, you know, let alone found a charity. But the experience of that, you know, the number of family members who gathered round the piano and who were smiling and laughing and chatting, strangers connecting, and how they were saying how their family members had slept for the first time in weeks or felt at ease or didn't feel agitated or distressed. And the staff, the wider hospice community saying how wonderful it was to hear music on the wards. And that one moment that was a hugely personal thing between Mum and I sort of connected every single person in that hospice, stranger or otherwise.
And can I ask, and you don't have to answer this if it's too personal, but did your mum react in any way?
No, so like all of my best performances, Mum slept through the entire thing. And you know what? I love that because it's so real. It's so real. And I have so many stories of how people have reacted in the most incredible ways. But Mum just slept silently and peacefully. You know, and I think that was enough. Like nothing more needed to happen because I felt just by playing the music that we were connected. There was almost this unwritten sort of connection, of course, the connection between mother and son, which is so strong, but this creative connection, you know, Mum took me to piano lessons, orchestras, concerts, you know, theatre. So she really was the driving force behind the music. So it felt like a way for me to honour her life and honour our connection. And that was enough. And there is a school of thought that the hearing is the last thing to go before you die. So I do like to think that in some ways the music would have seeped into that subconscious somehow.
And were you playing things that were personal to you and her?
Yeah, I remember playing like a mixture of sort of musical theatre songs, but also a lot of jazz music. I remember one of our first concerts, we went to see this wonderful Welsh jazz trio that would kind of rethink Bach and Chopin and reimagine it in sort of jazz form, jazz standards. And then I remember my first sort of proper live music gig when I turned 18 was to see the jazz musician Jamie Cullum in St. David's Hall. I remember this fabulous man sort of jumping all over this Steinway grand piano, literally jumping on it, on the keys, on the lid. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I remember my dad, my mum and us just sat there watching. And so I remember playing Pure Imagination by Jamie Cullum, which is this gorgeous kind of reflection on life. It's sort of ethereal, spiritual, you know, and the meaning of it when I look back now after seeing the growth of music in hospices about really, you know, if you want to change the world, there's nothing to it, is the lyric in that. And I'd like to think that through my experience with Mum and what we're doing with music in hospices, there's some essence of changing the world in what music in hospices does.
And you had examples of that, even though your mother, as you say, slept through it all. You had examples of other people coming and saying to you, this is doing us a lot of good, patients and visitors alike, presumably.
Yeah, you know, we did a pilot scheme just last year in Greenwich and Bexley Community Hospice. And the stories from there were just incredible. Stories of music bridging the gap between language, faith, culture, medical prognosis. There's three that really stand out. And of course, you can stop me after one, but I think the three most amazing ones. Firstly, there was a patient called Chris, and he was in the hospice with his daughter, Bonnie, and his grandchildren, Olivia and Finley. And I remember we were doing a performance just in the corridor, just playing a few songs, and Olivia and Finley, two young children, peered round the corner of the ward and sort of were very inquisitive, and they sort of slowly crept their way closer and closer to the piano and the harp, which were the two instruments we had in that particular session. And Olivia was absolutely fascinated by the harp. I mean, this beautiful sort of miraculously carved instrument with blue painted flowers on the bridge. And in a few minutes, we taught her and she learned Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star on the harp. And then Finley was a little more tentative, but after gentle encouragement, he started to play piano with me and explore the keys, and we played percussion together. And in the end, the four of us, the two musicians and Olivia and Finley, came together to play music together. Just something simple like Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, but it didn't matter because in that moment, Chris, their grandfather, was beaming, so happy that his grandchildren were enjoying themselves. Olivia and Finley exclaimed, "The hospice is so fun, when can we come back?" Which is always the most amazing thing, because you would never hear an adult say that, but to a child, this positive experience made the hospice the most amazing place to them. And then Bonnie was exceptionally moved by the whole thing, because she had been under a lot of societal pressure, parents in the schoolyard saying, "Oh, I'm not sure you should be taking your kids to a hospice. You know, it's a very depressing place. It's not suitable for children." And Bonnie said, "No, I think it's the right thing to do for them to connect with their grandfather, for one, but also to learn about this environment." And us being there, Olivia and Finley having such a positive experience, solidified to Bonnie that that was the right decision and enabled her to go back to the parents in the playground and say, "Actually, the hospice was wonderful. There were these musicians. It was lively. It was colourful." And in fact, and this is no word of a lie, but yesterday I had a message from Bonnie who said that Olivia and Finley still talk about it, that experience, and how it's one of their most cherished memories, and that Chris, her father, had passed away last month. And that session was maybe a year ago. So the longevity of that memory was not just in the moment, but a year later, Bonnie and her children are still remembering that experience.
That's fabulous, isn't it? And it would have changed the experience of their grandfather dying for them for the better, wouldn't it?
Well, I think so. And I think we don't give children and young people enough credit for their emotional capacity. So to Bonnie and Bonnie the mother, but to Olivia and Finley, the experience of the hospice was hugely positive. They knew that their grandfather was unwell. In fact, they sort of made light of it. They brought humour into the equation, which is almost such an adult thing to do. But to them, it was just this place of exploration, a place to be curious of. They had never experienced it before, so they wanted to learn. And so as society, we have two options, really. We either stay silent about it and make hospice and end-of-life care something to be scared of, a topic that's off the table, like a mysterious kind of monster, you know, like the boogeyman that comes to us in our dreams, but we can never find him and we don't know why he's scary, but he just is. That's almost how sort of we treat children and hospice and palliative care, the big monster that we don't want to talk about. Or we embrace it and say to our children, "This is a part of life. This place has a purpose, and that purpose is to care for people with a life-limiting illness, not just at the end of their life, but throughout their diagnosis. And this is a place that can be colourful. This is a place that has beautiful gardens, a lovely cafe, live music happens here, the creative arts happen here. You can come here to have massages if you're unwell, or you can come here for Tai Chi and yoga. This is a place of community." And children will then respond to that with complete acceptance and or further questions to support the fact that a hospice is a safe place. And the only reason why society is very scared to talk about death, dying and bereavement in the UK is because none of us have been brought up in a way that opens the dialogue around these topics early enough. So we grow up being fearful because we grow up in silence. And what I'm trying to do with music in hospices is really broaden the conversations to include all of society, from the very youngest to the very oldest.
You have your own reference point, don't you, to bear in mind all the time, as you described at the very beginning of this, how you first heard your mother was going into hospice and what that meant to you.
Yes, well, I described earlier on how the word hospice just sort of ignited fear within me, you know, because I lived with false hope for a number of years. And it was because my parents kept the prognosis of my mother's illness secret from me. And it was only until I happened to message my aunt, my mum's sister, and just said, just checking that mum's illness isn't terminal. And she said, call me. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's terminal. And my aunt told me, you know, this is a terminal diagnosis. We don't know how long mum has got left. But that was the first time, and that was very, very late on into her 9-year illness. And I realized I suffered as a result of that. And people ask me, do you blame your parents for not sharing that diagnosis sooner? And at the time, I would have said yes, I felt very angry. But the more I learn about society and how we deal with these topics, the more it's become compassion, because they struggled, they were scared, it was an enormous emotional weight for them, and they didn't have the tools to know how to discuss this with a child. And they tried their best, you know, they tried to shield me, to protect me from something that at that age, 12, 13 to the ages of 21, feels so existential. It's bigger than all of us, death. That it's a terrifying issue to have to discuss, or at least to them, it felt that way because of the limited tools society had given them. And so everything I think about with music in hospices now, we have the live music sessions, but we also have a children's book called Little Elephant Visits the Hospice, which is our educational tool to support children and young families navigate in a terminal illness diagnosis. And we also have a digital content series, Coffee Chats, where I take members of the palliative care community for coffee to sort of demystify these conversations around death, dying and bereavement in a very accessible, open, ordinary space like a coffee shop. So everything I do with music in hospices, all of the creative interventions are to ensure that future experiences, whether patients, children, or wider society, build on my experience and are more positive than the experience I had. And that's not to say my experience was wrong, because no one's experience is wrong. And there were aspects of my experience that were positive. But how can we improve it? How can we support society through the creative arts in a way that is healthy, helpful, and can be passed down the generations?
It is precisely what we're both trying to achieve, isn't it, really? Opening up the conversation so we don't have these horrid fears of things like the word death and dying and hospices and so on. And you and I obviously feel the same, that the more we talk about it, the more we demystify it and the better it is. But I know from friends that people don't always have that conversation.
Yeah, they don't. They don't have those conversations. And I think that's why our work with children is so important. You know, this children's book, Little Elephant, I launched it only a month ago, and already it's being used in three hospices across the UK, actually. It's going to be rolled out to 70 schools in the south of England. It's going to be donated to 30 families in Newport. It's used by Child Bereavement UK between their bereavement workers and children and young families. Maggie's Cancer Centres are going to stock the book in their libraries across the UK. And what I've seen is this tremendous movement of support for this little elephant and this children's book. And it's beautiful. And I think it shows that it's overdue, it's well needed, and actually this book is the only resource, I think, in the UK that covers the diagnosis of a terminal illness through to hospice, through to death, dying, and bereavement in its entirety. And interestingly enough, next year we're going to launch a partnership with the Dean's Close Foundation in Gloucester, a foundation of maybe sort of 15 private schools. And Little Elephant is going to be the basis of workshops around death, dying, and bereavement, but from a very positive view of legacy building and remembrance. And we're going to use music and create compositions to celebrate life. And if it all works out, we might be reaching almost 1,000 students with that work. Come back to me in a year and I'll tell you how we've done. But the ability of just this children's book, Little Elephant Visits the Hospice, to be used so quickly in so many different settings, from hospices to child bereavement to schools, is quite extraordinary. And I think it shows that there is a turning point in society where we realize that actually to improve civic engagement with hospices and end-of-life care and to support those grieving and with bereavement more generally, we have to start our intervention at a young age. So actually what we cultivate is a generation of children and young people who are death literate, who are hospice literate, who are resilient and unafraid and understand that life is impermanent, but through that live in a way that is more conscious, and as a product of that, give them the tools to really grieve healthily, but also use the power of grief and transform it into a tool that can transform the world.
And I love your use of the elephant. The elephant does crop up quite often in conversations about death and dying, doesn't it? Because it is the elephant in the room that we don't address. So it seems very appropriate.
Yes, the elephant is an interesting one. I chose the elephant because it's one of my favourite animals. And I didn't quite realise how wonderful elephants' memories are. So each year, elephants will return to the same spot where their loved one died to pay tribute to them. And that was so interesting to me because I almost thought in that moment that elephants at this stage have got a greater capacity to grieve and to understand death, dying, and bereavement than some humans do. And I mean that not condescendingly, but in a way that sort of feels like, well, if we're part of nature and part of the world, so maybe we can learn something from elephants. And of course, it's the elephant in the room as well, which is where the idea came from. But the elephant as a symbol for compassion and remembrance, I think I love as well.
So you mentioned earlier on that you had three examples. You told us one of the magical effect of music in hospices. What were the other two?
There was such a special moment with a patient called Tatiana, and we were performing on the wards, and Tatiana's mother stepped through the door from her daughter's bedside, drawn by the music, and she was visibly moved, and after listening for a while, applauded and apologised because she didn't speak English. She only spoke Russian. And so she used Google Translate and she said, and I quote, "For this great help of music, we are all connected, all between heaven and earth. All the energy of God passes through us. You give people energy in this hard hour. Thank you from the bottom of my heart." And she was crying at this point, tears in her eyes, saying thank you repeatedly in English, and we all cried together. But in that moment, music moved across language, culture, and faith without a single word being needed. So that's remarkable to me. You know, we spend a lot of time in the hospice sector thinking about ways we can broach the topic of religion, faith, culture. And in that moment, music just did it automatically. There was no thought. It was just music. And music in that moment became the unquenchable expression of the human soul. No words were needed. And the final one, which was during our first concert, was Bridget. And Bridget was diagnosed with a terminal brain tumor, and she had been in a coma for 2 weeks. And the nurses told me she wouldn't respond. She hadn't reacted to medical intervention, so she wouldn't react to music. So I asked them to tell me about her life, and she was raised in Ireland, and she had a great love of rugby. And I began playing Fields of Athen Rye, a great rugby tune. And within the first verse, Bridget woke. She began singing, every word perfect. And when the music ended, she didn't slip back into a coma. She sat up and spoke.
Wow.
Stories of her childhood in Ireland, and she laughed whilst recounting frosty autumn Six Nation rugby matches. She cried, recalling how she missed her husband, expressed love for her daughter and her grandchildren, and her daughter sobbed because she thought her mother had already died, but in 10 minutes of music, they reconnected. And when I looked into Bridget's eyes, and this was the first performance we had done, I saw my own mother. They had the same illness, Bridget and Mum. And I thought about how different both of their care would have been without music. And then it sort of reminded me that in those moments when medical intervention quietens, we hand our loved ones over from the hands of medicine into the hands of the world. And in that moment, what becomes the most important thing? And I think the nourishment of the soul is perhaps the most important of all. And at the center of the soul are the creative arts. And what we've seen with Bridget, Tatiana, Olivia, and Finley is that for them, the way that they were able to reconcile with illness, with mortality, was through music.
Joe, thank you so much for that today. That was fabulous talking to you, and good luck with music in hospices and with your book, Little Elephant Goes to the Hospice. And I wish you every success in helping other people at the end of their lives or the lives of their loved ones. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.